Good morning. Happy Easter. Today we celebrate that new life is possible amidst all that is dying and fading away in our lives. And when I imagine celebrating new life, I think of it like a big party, kind of like this, where people are full of joy and really excited to see one another and have fun. It's kind of how the author Brené Brown describes watching the Astros win the World Series last year and being so excited at the game that she reached into her husband's back pocket to give him a little squeeze and didn't even mind that her husband had left to use the restroom. And it was a stranger who politely said, excuse me, ma'am, go Astros. Yes, there are a few celebrations that really help us overcome all that separates us, and today invites us into just such a place. And yet, if I really think about my experiences of new life, of God showing up in fresh ways, they are often more complex than I was anticipating. In fact, it's rare that new life ever shows up in just the way we are expecting. When our son was born, I pretty much knew what to expect. I had seen dozens of birthing moments on TV and the movies. I knew I would be the father with tears holding a pudgy pink baby that's really actually about a month old, with a little bit of damp hair swaddled, with no umbilical cord in sight, who would cry just two short times, just two. Yeah, you laugh. And when I took him into my arms for the first time, he would immediately become calm, somehow knowing I was his father through our holding one another's gaze. He would sigh with relief. He would look at me as if to say, boy, I'm glad that's over, and begin to smile and coo, maybe giggle a little. You see, I pretty much knew just exactly what my encounter with new life would be like. But imagine my surprise when a cone-headed, slimy purple creature with a white film flailing, inconsolably crying, appeared in what could only be described as a scene from the movie Aliens. Sigourney Weaver, the lead actress from this movie trilogy, and her encounters with the baby aliens trying to eat her, had done more to prepare me for this moment than any sterilized images of childbirth I had seen on a screen. Now, I love my son, and being a part of his life has been better than I could have ever hoped. But my first encounter wasn't what I thought it would be. He showed up in a way I wasn't prepared for. In fact, I really thought that everyone had lied to me about birth and parenting in that moment. But thankfully, I was wrong. Today, we're going to join two people who are encountering new life in a very different way than they were expecting. And in a way, they were completely unprepared for. They were grieving the loss of a beloved teacher and friend. More than that, were devastated that God didn't show up the way they knew he would. They were expecting beauty and justice and are now crushed by images of torture and suffering. Yet we'll see how patient Jesus is with their slowness to process and be open to a new experience of his presence today. And I hope we'll find courage to lean into the ways that new life is present to each of us today. So here are the words from Luke's account of Jesus' followers processing his death and the disappearance of his body a couple days later. And I'll invite you to read aloud together from your little booklet there, as is our custom, from the Gospel of Luke. You can read together or at your own pace. Right off, we see that for these two who love Jesus and for us, that new life is already present in ways we don't yet recognize. It starts off a little sooner. Now that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. So it's like maybe a 2 to 3 hour walk, depending on how fast you walk. And they were talking with each other about everything that had happened. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. So we don't know exactly what kept them from recognizing him. Maybe his appearance is different. I tend to think it was also something internal, perhaps their disappointment or grief, which can sometimes be so intense it eclipses our ability to see what's right in front of us. He asked them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who doesn't know the things that have happened there in these days?" Just right on time. It's a dramatic pause. It's like he's saying, how can you not know? Isn't that the way when we face loss and encounter someone who hasn't heard? Our loss is so big sometimes, it seems strange when we see life just going on as usual, or we have to explain. When we are overwhelmed with disappointment, confusion, and pain, oftentimes before we can even begin to care about or see new life or God being present with us, we need a minute to acknowledge what's been lost. You see, the first Easter started in grief, a grief so intense that they couldn't recognize the one they were grieving. And Jesus gave them space to name their loss. It says they stood still, their faces downcast. And one of the ways our losses can be named is through forgiveness. In the act of forgiving, we are invited to face pain in those who have injured us and let go. During this Lent, I've been trying to give up despair, which is hard because despair is one of my spiritual gifts. I'm really awesome at it, for real. But one thing that has helped me name loss and move beyond it is to forgive. In a wonderful book entitled Falling Upward, I found these words recently. The tragic sense of life is not unbelief, pessimism, fatalism, or cynicism. It is just ultimate and humiliating realism, which for some reason demands a lot of forgiveness of almost everything. Faith is simply to trust the real and to trust that God is found within it, even before we change it. This is perhaps our major stumbling stone, the price we must pay to keep the human heart from closing down and to keep the soul open for something more. When we see life as it really is, which has a lot of tragedy and suffering, if we want to keep our hearts open, it will require some forgiveness. To forgive means to give up the power to punish and to stop giving our power away. It is when we hold on to our broken pictures and broken relationships that these continue to hold power over us and make our lives so heavy. So what or who do we need to forgive today? What is keeping us from seeing? Perhaps we relate to these two walking together who were still carrying their dead ideas of who Jesus was and what God was about. Perhaps there are ways we need to forgive God for not being what we thought, for not holding up his end of what we thought the deal was. Maybe today we could let God off the hook just a little. Or perhaps like me, it's time to forgive life for being so much harder than you thought, for disappointing in ways too many to count. Or maybe it's a person that you're just bone-weary tired of holding something against. You can forgive them without trusting them yet. I would invite us to let that go just a little. Not saying we're okay with what happened, but that us holding it doesn't keep us from being hurt that way again. It just shrinks our hearts and our lives back from joy and growth. So our prayer of release today could sound like this, and you're welcome to pray this internally if you want. God, or life, I forgive you for being so hard, for being unfair, for having more pain than I can stand, for being disappointing, for not giving me what I thought, for giving me things I didn't want. I forgive you. I'm tired of holding this against you. I'm sorry, I forgive you. And you could take a deep breath with me and just let go a little bit. And when we name our loss just a little, as these two travelers do in our passage, and begin to forgive, we experience along with them a kind of deep patience and awareness that new life embraces our disillusionment. Jesus asked them to share more. What things, he asked. About Jesus of Nazareth, they replied. He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it is the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but didn't find his body. They came and told us that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see Jesus. So it's not even that their vision of who they thought Jesus was didn't happen. Like, they thought he was going to overthrow the Roman oppressors. But even grief itself is taken from them. They're not able to grieve because his body is gone. It would be like going to a funeral and being told you should be happy rather than being given permission to fall apart a little bit. Even that has been taken. And then the most confusing thing happens. The stranger starts speaking to them in a way a teacher would talk with his students. Jesus said to them, "How foolish you are and how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory?" And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. We'll just meditate on that for a moment. So what's important is that he makes room for their disillusionment, and then he kind of challenges them or rattles them a little bit. He speaks to them in a way only a person who has the authority of deep love can speak to you and create openness rather than defensiveness. And I'm amazed at Jesus' patience with them and us in our holding on to pictures of what we thought it was going to be like. I, on the other hand, when I've read this scripture over the years, I used to really struggle with these two for not getting it when Jesus returned. I'm like, he's right there. Like, why are you crying and complaining? Jeez, you know, a lot of empathy. But then I started to wonder just this year, maybe I just didn't understand what they were really feeling, what they had really lost. And it wasn't until I was hearing an interview last month with Brené Brown talking about her research on belonging. And something clicked for me when she shared this story. 8 to 9 years ago, I was interviewing middle schoolers for my research on belonging and asked them, what's the difference between fitting in and belonging? And they had these incredibly simple and profound answers. Fitting in is when you want to be part of something. Belonging is when others want you. They were rattling one off after another, and then a young girl raised her hand and said, "You know, miss, it's really hard not to fit in or belong at school, but not belonging at home is the worst." And then she said, when she said that, probably half the kids either burst into tears or put their heads down, like they were unable to speak. Other kids gave examples like, "My parents were athletic and popular. I'm not athletic. I'm not popular. I don't fit in with my family. I don't belong there." And she goes on, "This thing washed over me for a middle schooler to say, hey, not belonging here is tough, but there's nothing worse than not belonging at home. You understood, and I felt the magnitude of it in my bones." Just let that sink in for a minute. She goes on, "Even though I lived it, I had never thought about not belonging at home as being such a universal experience of pain." And when I was listening to this, I was walking into HEB, and I was in the middle of the parking lot, and I just stopped, and I was just caught by tears, because I knew it was true. And later, when I read again of these two disillusioned ones, I felt a flood of empathy for them I had not had before. Oh, what if they just lost the only belonging they had ever known? Of course they're devastated beyond belief, which makes the way Jesus cares for them all the more beautiful. Jesus isn't in a hurry. He doesn't flinch at their despair or loss of faith or loss of hope because he knows that Good Friday isn't the end of the story, and the emptiness of the tomb isn't the last word. There is fresh life coming, shaking loose the threads of death and dank darkness. And even though in that moment Easter was there, it was present and they couldn't see it, God was patient. So on this fine morning, I'd invite you to consider that new life might already be with you. Even if your life feels like this barren tree behind me, God is patient. Even when we are stuck and have lost our vision, lost our way, the sap of spring is already moving into the trunk and branches. The leaves and buds are coming. Hold on. What is your disillusionment today? I thought I was getting a baby and ended up with an alien. He's not an alien anymore. He's a really wonderful person. I thought friendship would be safe, but it turns out. I thought marriage would be easy, but it turns out. I thought I'd be married by now or have kids by now, but it turns out. I thought God would be accessible and present with me no matter what, but it turns out. I thought life would be fill in the blank, but it turns out. And in the patience of Jesus with their disillusionment, our companions today discover how new life breaks open the ordinary meaning of our days. It continues as they approach the village to which they were going. Jesus continued on as if he were going farther. But they urged him strongly, "Stay with us, for it is nearly evening. The day is almost over." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us?" Jesus could have done so many things to open their eyes. Like, he could have healed someone. He could have told like a bad Jesus joke that only they would have recognized, kind of like a bad dad joke. I don't think there are any bad dad jokes, for the record, but my kids have said otherwise. He could have brought a new teaching. He could have become a being of pure light. There were so many things he could have done. But he does what's even more characteristic of who he was. He does the most Jesus thing of all by just eating with his friends. For many, Jesus did the most to heal their cultural violence by sitting around a table with people he wasn't supposed to eat with. It's his blessing of bread and feeding his beloved that opens their eyes and helps them see that he was with them the whole time. They just had this experience on the road where they are working through their grief and disillusionment. They're being challenged in their despair. It's slowly dawning on them, wait a minute, there's something familiar, something of God in this encounter, and yet it's different. And then gathered around a meal, as Jesus does the simple gesture of breaking the bread, he breaks open the meaning of their experience, just as they are ready to see it. And then he disappears, which I think is kind of cool. And I always wonder if this isn't inviting us to be open to his form continuing to change as we journey. And I really, really think it matters that it's bread. It's bread. It's the most ordinary part of their experience, the most taken for granted element of the day. This is where the realization of Easter pierces their awareness. And I began to ask this week, what is the thing in my life that's too obvious to have anything to do with deep reality? Like, what is the everyday thing that I barely see? It's so normal and usual that I wouldn't even think to look for God there. So if you know our family, we've always had a lot of animals. And we have many psychological theories for this as to why we have a lot of animals. But the fact remains that there are just a lot of strays we take in or animals we find on Craigslist. I'm not asking for any more. Our most recent addition is a small dog with huge ears. His body looks like a tiny white cow with tan spots. And his head is like a bat, like he's got these huge ears with these really sad eyes and this cute snout. But trust me, the cuteness wears off. We got him about 3 months ago, and we named him Bean, of course. And the name Bean was apt because he looked like a little bean when he slept. But more so now, we've realized this name fits because he has the bladder of a small bean. And I don't mean like a kidney bean or a pinto bean. I'm talking like a lentil. And I wondered, like, why am I so frustrated with this dog that keeps going to the bathroom in the house? I mean, you may relate, and that isn't a question. But I was like, why didn't he come house trained? Why do I have to keep telling him to stop going on the carpet? And I realized, as I was kind of reflecting this week, a lot of my frustration, I'm like shaming, I'm like bad, being bad, which I feel bad for. And he just looks at me like, what did I do? I'm just going to the bathroom. I realized, and then I looked up online, you're not supposed to do that. Like, it doesn't teach them anything. The dog whisperer would be not proud of me. But I realized a lot of my growing up years, I was expected very early on to figure things out on my own. And when I didn't, I was shamed and met with impatience and anger. And I realized, oh, this is exactly how I'm responding to this poor little dog. Like, I'm giving him the impatience, the shame and anger I received when I was young and vulnerable. And as soon as I saw this connection, my heart was broken open to new meaning. And I actually felt like some affection for the dog that I hadn't been feeling and some empathy. So when I see Bean, like most days, not all days, and I'm patiently teaching him where to relieve himself, I actually sense that God is healing something in me, if that makes sense, like undoing some shame in my early days and giving me permission to be a learner who doesn't have it all figured out before I even try. So my image of God in my life anew, my bread broken open, is this strange little dog, this little cow-bodied, bat-headed dog. Like, this is the new life of Christ to me right now. I know. It's a dog. So I just want to ask this morning, what is your bread? Who is your bean? Friends, there's new life in your journey today. God is with you. And you may not be able to see it yet. And it may not be very different. It may be very different from what you've been looking for. And God is patient. And when you're ready, you may find that it's as close to you as a cool drink, a soft breeze, or the kindness of a God who is so consumed with loving you, he has no time or interest in judging you. One of my favorite things to say to people when they're over-explaining themselves, because I do it a lot also, is to say, you'd be amazed at how disinterested I am in judging you right now. Because this is who I know God to be, whose presence is most visible in the fractal of this moment. Our first Easter began in pain and patient listening, and it ended in a simple meal with a guest who became the host and food that helped them see. Please pray with me. May we leave this Easter celebration with a renewed curiosity for how new life is present. Even if we can't see it or feel it in any way, may we leave knowing we are accepted. You are completely accepted today, just where you are in your life, in all of the mess and all of the wonder. And may we wonder at the smallest things that may crack us wide to mercy and healing and hope, even as we exhaust ourselves in our reach for the bigger and better. For with Jesus, there is a joy and possibility available, even as we've got it all wrong. Such is the love of God, such is the truth of our faith on this beautiful day. May it be so today and every day to come. In the patience of the Father, the love of the Son, and the beauty of the Holy Spirit. Amen.